Hello, I'm Ken Smith, CEO of Empirical Wealth Management. My business partner, Jack Monteith, and I co-host a financial radio show that airs in Washington, Oregon, and Alaska. The name of our show is Successful Investing Radio. Recently on our show, Jack and I had the opportunity to interview a nationally recognized author, Larry Swedrow. Larry has an MBA in finance and investment from NYU, where he graduated number one in his class. He has authored or co-authored 6 books to date and is in the process of writing a 7th book on alternative investments. With Larry's first book, The Only Guide to a Winning Investment Strategy You'll Ever Need, Larry was one of the first authors to publish a book that explained the passive approach to investing in simple terms. And one of our favorite books written by Larry is Rational Investing in Irrational Times. And in our interview with Larry, we discussed insights from his latest book, Why is Investing Made Simple? We hope you find our interview with Larry insightful. And for those of you who are existing clients, we hope that it reaffirms the value of our investment approach, which is a deviation from Wall Street's conventional wisdom. And for those of you who are considering working with Empirical as your financial advisor, we hope you find this interview gives you an idea of how capital markets work and some of the foundational concepts inherent in Empirical Wealth Management's investment philosophy. Please call us at 1-800-923-4307 or visit our website at empiricalwm.com to learn about our investment management and wealth management services. To listen to past radio shows, please visit our radio website at successfulinvestingradio.com. You may also subscribe to our show on iTunes and receive automatic updates. Thank you, and we hope you enjoy.
The advice given on this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended as investment advice. Please consult a financial advisor before undertaking any investment decisions. While the show's producers have tried to provide accurate and timely information and have relied on sources they believe to be reliable, the show may include inadvertent technical or factual inaccuracies. Jack Monteith and Ken Smith do not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the materials provided and expressly disclaim any warranties or merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose.
We're here with author Larry Swedrow, talking about his new book, Why is Investing Made Simple? Larry Swedrow's Tales to Enrich Your Future. And Larry, I read this book, and Jack has read the book as well, along with several of the books you've written, and I find them all to be incredibly insightful and very useful in our practice in sharing the passive approach to investing. And I guess the first question I have for you is, can you explain why you wrote this book and how this book is different from the other books you've written?
Sure. Well, first, I'm glad you've enjoyed the books and found it helpful. Despite its importance in our lives, money is probably the third most important thing after our health and our families. And, of course, it's not money in itself, but what it could do for you, like provide a good retirement, a good education for your children, allow you to donate a large amount of money to charity, or whatever is important to you about money. You know, our education system has failed the public. And unless you take a course in capital markets theory in an MBA program, it's unlikely that you've ever taken a single course in investment theory. And therefore, you're left to what I would call the wolves of Wall Street and the financial media to get your knowledge, and I put quotation marks around knowledge, about investing. And the problem is that the Wall Street and the media both have a conflict. They need you to believe that active management is the best strategy. By that, I mean either stock picking and or market timing, that's the best strategy because it's the winning strategy for them. They make the most money because they can charge you big fees for trying to beat the market, and they make money every time you trade as market makers, and they earn commissions. And the media, of course, CNBC and Money Magazine, they need you to what I call tune in so you can learn who is the hot fund manager or which is the best stock to buy. If they told you to be a passive buy and hold investor, you know, how many times could they say it before you wouldn't have to tune in? So the problem is, while we have these two theories about investing, we believe that passive is the right approach and the Wall Street and the media want you to believe the other is right. All of the academic literature and now almost 60 years of research shows that the strategy most likely to get you the best results is a passive strategy. So I set out to write books to explain people and educate them, because I believe education is the armor, if you will, that protects you from these wolves of Wall Street. And finally, this book is different because, you know, I'd written 6 books and they're sprinkled throughout with little stories and analogies to make difficult concepts easy to use, stories related to cooking and gardening and movies and sports and history. But I've learned that there are many people who are still intimidated by investing and won't read a 300-page investment book that cites 150, you know, stud academic papers and is filled with all kinds of data. So I decided to write a much simpler book that contains just 27 simple stories that anyone can read and enjoy and learn from. And so far, the reception, as you said, has been terrific. People seem to love the book, and the most common expression I get is, it's been an aha moment. Boy, I finally understand how markets work.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I loved about the book. And if you'd be kind enough to share with us one of the illustrations and how you used it to explain how capital markets work, that'd be great.
Yeah. You know, I think the most important thing about the book is that it takes this totally different approach. It uses a story like the one I'll go into in a moment, and it explains how people, you know, think markets work, and then it explains how they actually do work. It provides a lesson, and each story ends with a moral so people can walk away with some useful information. So I think probably the most common mistake that people make is they confuse what I call information with knowledge or wisdom. So, for example, it's very easy to identify the better football team. Last year, if your Seattle Seahawks were playing my St. Louis Rams, most people would know that the Seattle Seahawks were a much better team and almost certainly would win. In fact, they won both games. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't do you any good in terms of trying to win money betting on the Seattle Seahawks, because the markets already know that information is incorporated, if you will, into the price. So if you wanted to bet on the Seahawks, you might have had to give me, say, 15 points, and if Seattle won by only 14, then you'd lose your bet. And it turns out that studies on sports betting show that the point spread is what's called an unbiased estimator of the outcome. It doesn't predict that the Rams will actually, you know, lose by exactly 15 points, but it turns out half the time they win by more than the point spread, the favorite, and half the time the favorite wins by less or even loses. So it's impossible to benefit from it. So the analogy I then make to investing is this. If you have, say, GE and Ford, one is a great company, the other might go bankrupt. Well, if I asked you which company is the Seattle Seahawks, I'm sure you'd say GE, and the Rams would be Ford. So again, it's easy to identify the better company, but it tells you nothing about which is a better investment, because you might pay 20 times earnings for GE, and you might only pay 7 times earnings for Ford, and the P.E. ratios make them equally good investments in the same way the point spreads make them equally good bets, despite the fact that Seattle's a much better team, and everybody knows it, and GE is a much better company. So that's one example of how I try to use these analogies to everyday life to show how markets really work and to change people's perceptions. So researching all you want about GE, and you find out it's a much better company, it's got better products, and Cramer tells you their earnings are going to explode, that you learn nothing more than GE has a better quarterback, better running backs, better defensive backs. In other words, the market knows it, and it's built into prices.
So basically, in order to profit from that knowledge, you would have to know something that the rest of the market doesn't.
That's exactly right, and the thing I try to teach people is twofold. One, if it's information the market doesn't have, Martha Stewart found out what happens if you try to exploit that. And the other is, whenever you think it's really something the market doesn't know, ask yourself where you learned it. If you heard it from Cramer, it's certainly on CNBC, it's certainly not a national secret. If you read it in Money Magazine, it's certainly not a national secret. And if you heard it from your stockbroker or investment banker or whoever, it's certainly, isn't a national secret because you're not the first one they called. I'm sure they told the, you know, the big hedge funds who they do tens of billions of dollars of trading with before they've told you. So it has no value to you whatsoever. And that's the biggest mistake investors make.
Well, I really appreciate how you illustrate in the book, and it's leading into my next question about market efficiency, that, you know, this idea that information gets evaluated and put into the prices, or here we're talking about the spreads between teams based on how good they are. And as we look at the stock market, you know, market efficiency is at the core of our investment philosophy. And I think a lot of people get confused about what it really means. And I'd love to hear, you know, how you explain or you know, this idea of market efficiency and how you developed your belief in market efficiency.
Right. Well, first, it's important that people make a lot of mistakes about market efficiency. Market efficiency does not mean that stock prices are correct. What it means is that stock prices are the best estimate of what is the right price, and it is very difficult to exploit any pricing errors once you account for all of the expenses of the effort. And the reason I came to believe that markets were highly efficient, if not perfectly so, is the vast body of evidence that shows that the vast majority of professional investors and individuals who try to beat the market underperform, and even the very best investors, you might say pension plans, for example, have access to all the great money managers. They certainly have never hired a manager who didn't have a good track record. I've sat on the boards of public companies. I know that the people on these pension plans are very smart people who are diligent in their process. They hire the best consultants to help them choose the top managers, and yet they fail persistently in their efforts. And the reason is, first of all, most money managers underperform, and the very few who succeed, there tends to be almost no persistence in performance anyway. And here's an amazing statistic, I think, that will impress almost anybody, except the diehard hard believers in active management. There's a study done on pension plans that covered over 9,000 hiring and firing decisions. And as you would expect, the funds that were hired to run the plans all had great track records in the 3 years prior to them hiring, all had what we call alpha or market outperformance, and yet after they were hired, the alphas disappeared. In other words, there was no benefit at all any longer. You would have been better off in an index fund, and that did not even count the cost of transitioning the plan from one money manager to the new one, because the new one obviously doesn't like the stocks the old one held.
Right.
So it seems like pension plans are banging the heads against the wall, making the same mistakes over and over again. You know, and Einstein said the definition of insanity is repeating the same behavior and expecting a different outcome.
That's a good one. Well, Larry, you know, you hear a lot of, you know, I was just reading an article recently about market efficiency across different parts of the market, and a lot of the active managers now will admit, yeah, the market's fairly efficient in large U.S. companies, but small companies and emerging markets and some of these places that are less followed by the analysts, there's still opportunities to exploit inefficiencies. What are your views on that?
Well, there's two answers to the question. First of all, by a mathematical certainty, all active managers in aggregate must underperform all passive investors, and it is totally regardless of whether we're talking about the total stock market or any sub-asset class like large caps, small caps, emerging markets, or any asset class you care to name, and it's easy to demonstrate that. In my book, The Successful Investor Today, 14 Simple Truths, the first chapter goes into both the math and the evidence, but let's walk through it very quickly and simply. If the stock market, for example, goes up 10%, and I own Vanguard's total stock market fund, and I'm a passive investor, I must get 10% before any expenses. So all passive investors can get 10% less very low expenses. That means as a group, all active investors must also get 10% on a gross basis, because the sum of the parts must equal the whole, and there's only two types of investors, active and passive.
Right.
So if both groups get 10% before expenses, And active managers have higher expenses, both in trading costs, bid offer spreads, transaction fees, market impact costs, and the operating expense ratios, let alone their tax inefficiency created from their trading, then passive investors must have higher net returns because they subtract less from the gross returns. Now, by the way, that's also true if the market went down 10%, then my Vanguard passively managed fund would go down 10%, which means all active managers in aggregate must go down 10%. So that proves disproves the statement by active managers that they can protect you from bear markets. It's impossible. And the same thing is true whether we talk about small caps or emerging markets. Because if we talk about small caps and small caps go up, say, 15%, I own Vanguard's index fund, it's going up 15%, less low expenses. The active managers as a group must also go up 15%, less high expenses. In aggregate, I must outperform them. Now, that leaves you with the fact that some active managers will outperform the benchmark. So if one, the average is 15, one might have gotten 20 and another only 10. The problem is there's no way to identify ahead of time the few who are likely to win. And that's evidence in that example I told you on the pension plan. So the first statement is this. If an active manager tells you that they can win because markets are inefficient, they, you should just tell them they simply cannot add. They should be forced to walk around with a T-shirt that says, I cannot add.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean they can't, but individually, every one of them must believe they can, and yet, obviously, by definition, most must fail. But, of course, they won't tell you that because that would be committing economic suicide. And that's exactly what the evidence says. Once you properly adjust for what the holdings of mutual funds, active managers lose in every asset class.
And I know I've read that in more than one of your books, Larry, where you say, we all can't be above average.
Now, we all like to think we're above average, but obviously that's impossible. But there is a way to guarantee you will be above average investor, and that's by simply investing in index funds, because all the people who don't will end up, by definition, on average, with worse returns than you, assuming you have the discipline to stay the course.
Right.
So the confusion caused by active managers is they say, well, you don't want to index. Indexing is a good strategy, but that gets you average returns. You can do better. You don't want to be average.
Right.
That's a lie. What indexing gets you is it gets you market returns, less very low costs in a highly tax-efficient way. Active management gets you market returns in a high-cost and tax-inefficient way. And therefore, by definition, if you're passive, you get market returns and you outperform the average active investor. So you are, by definition, above average.
Well, that's a great explanation. You know, Larry, we did a show recently where we really explained some of the basic concepts about hedge funds. You know, what is a hedge fund? How do you define it? How they get paid? What is your view on hedge funds and how do they fit into an efficient market? And do you recommend that investors include them in their portfolio?
Well, let me say first, I'll quote Professor Eugene Fama, one of the top academic lights in the field, and he said, if you want to invest in something where they steal your money and don't tell you what they're doing, be my guest. And that's my bottom line on hedge funds. I'm writing a new book now, which will be out in November, called The Only Guide to Alternative Investments You'll Ever Need. Covers 20 alternative investments, from real estate and commodities and tips to private equity and hedge funds and covered call writing strategies, preferred stocks, etc. And I will tell you that the chapter on hedge funds is by far the longest because I think it's the most important. There are great academic papers on the subject, and the bottom line are this. The historical evidence on hedge funds shows that the average hedge fund, once you adjust for risks, has a very hard time keeping up with the returns of treasury bills, and they do it, of course, in a highly tax-inefficient manner. There's no persistence of performance beyond the randomly expected. Hedge funds of hedge funds, which at least give you more diversification and reduce that risk, underperform miserably just as well. The evidence is unbelievably compelling. It is far worse for hedge funds than the average mutual than the average mutual fund, which is bad enough to start with in the beginning. Hedge funds are absolute disasters for the average investor. And here's an interesting insight. David Swensen, who is often pointed to by hedge fund people to say, you know, he invests in hedge funds. David Swensen is the chief investment officer of the legendary Yale Endowment.
Right.
Now, David Swensen has had great returns, partly because he invested with some hedge fund managers, but he invests quite differently. Number one, he doesn't pay, as the average investor might do, 2% and 20% of profits. He's going to negotiate with them for much, much lower fees because he wields a lot of market power, and the hedge funds know he can write a huge check to them. And on top of that, he carries a lot of credibility, so if they get his money, they know they can get other money. So he doesn't bear the same cost hurdles that individual investors would bear in using hedge funds. So Swensen, when he wrote his book, Unconventional Wisdom, he told people, here's how I invested for Yale, got these great returns. And then he set out to write a book for individual investors to tell them how they could do the same thing. And basically he realized, you know what, they can't do it. My advice to individuals is you should use index funds and globally diversify.
Wow.
So he agrees with us completely.
That's a pretty strong statement. Well, if markets are efficient and it's clear that you have a passion and you're also armed with a stack of academic and empirically proved data that says they are, what are the implications for individual investors and what should they do right now? If they're sitting at home listening to the show and they've got a pool of active managers or they're working with a financial advisor who's actively picking stocks, what's your advice to them?
Well, first of all, there's both bad news and good news in market efficiency. The bad news is that you should give up hope of trying to beat the market, not because it's impossible to do so, but the data shows that about 90% of individuals and institutions, once you risk adjust returns over the long term, are doomed to fail. So I don't like those odds of success. I don't want to try to win a game with my retirement money where the odds of my failure are 90%. That doesn't make sense for any individual. That's the bad news. You have to accept the fact you're not going to beat the market in all likelihood. However, the good news is you don't have to beat the market to have a great investment experience. You know, the stock markets have provided over the long term about 10% a year. If you were willing to take more risk in small value stocks, you got something like 14% a year. And boy, if you can get that rate of return for the next 30 or 40 years, you're almost certainly going to have a good investment experience. The hard part for people is they seem unable to, for mostly emotional reasons, and lack of knowledge about the failure of active management, to just simply stay the course. They panic in bear markets and sell typically low, and then in bull markets like the late 90s, they get over-aggressive, take far too much risk, and tend to buy high. And so they end up with far worse returns than provided by the markets. And here's one other bit of data. There's a concept called time-weighted returns versus dollar-weighted returns. The time-weighted returns are the returns reported by mutual funds. They assume you invest a dollar in day one and then stay through the end of the period. And that's exactly the way mutual funds report when you look in the Wall Street Journal or Morningstar. However, investors don't invest that way. They're adding assets, pulling money out of funds, you know, jumping in and out. Well, it turns out that in almost every single case that was studied, and in fact it was true of every mutual fund family but one, the time-weighted returns reported by mutual funds dramatically, in most cases, outperformed the actual returns earned by investors in those very same funds.
Wow.
In other words, investors earned 5% while their funds were getting 10. How did that happen? A fund would go up 20%, then they would first buy. Maybe it was Bill Miller who had this great track record. And then after he does very poorly, and by the way, here's a guy who had 15 years of beating the market. In 2006, he trailed by 10%. Last year, he trailed by 12%. This year, he's down by almost 15% already. And so clearly, the average investor probably did much worse than the returns reported by his fund because they bought high and are now first selling low. There was only one mutual fund family that wasn't true of, And in fact, the returns earned by investors were higher than the returns reported by the mutual fund company. And that is in the case of dimensional fund advisors. And that's because there are advisors like you who are forcing your clients, if you will, to stay disciplined. And when an asset class does poorly, instead of panicking and selling, we get our clients to buy more of it. And when an asset class does great, outperforming, we sell some of it, not because we're making any predictions, but we're simply rebalancing the portfolio. And so you have ended up with higher returns than the mutual funds actually reported. So the answer is simple. Just believe in market efficiency, but that's not enough. You have to stay the course, and that seems to be almost impossible for most people to do.
Right. So would you recommend that people out there that are using an active strategy abandon that strategy and go to a passive approach?
Well, the active strategy is a sunk cost, and when you learn something is highly likely to provide you with a poor result, only an irrational person would continue to do it. Again, like Einstein says, the definition of insanity is repeating a behavior and expecting a different outcome.
Well, that's great. Larry, do you have any information relating to the percentage of institutions and individuals who utilize a passive approach relative to an active approach? And is there any trend towards the passive approach in light of all the academic evidence that's come out?
Yeah, actually, there are good trends. We have at least some reasonable estimates. Say 15, 20 years ago, only a few percent of individual money was indexed, and maybe 10 or 15% of institutional money was indexed. Today, that number is probably around 40% for institutions and about 15% for individuals. And the reason that while we have a trend in both cases moving towards passive investing, the institutions are moving faster is because they are more aware of the academic research. Individuals are bombarded by Wall Street and the media, who doesn't want them to know all this information. But it's getting out there by people like me writing books, and John Bogle and William Bernstein and a few others. And so people are also getting tired of the poor outcomes they're experiencing, and you're seeing a massive trend. Dimensional fund advisors, which I think is the best provider of passive funds in the world, that's why we use them, they have grown. When I first met them, they were at about $20 billion of assets in 1996. 12 years later, they're up to $160 billion or so. So obviously there is a clear trend towards passive investing in both worlds.
Right.
And I'm sure it will continue.
Well, that's great news for investors. Larry, the first book I read of yours was Rational Investing in Irrational Times, and it's a book that Jack and I love. We give it out to clients in our practice with Empirical. We've mentioned it on our radio show several times. We've actually offered it as a prize to clients who answered some finance questions. So we love that book, and in that book, you list out 52 common mistakes that investors make. And I was just curious if you wouldn't mind sharing with our listeners just a few of those mistakes. What do you think some of the, besides investing in active mutual funds, which is definitely a big mistake, what are the other two or three mistakes that you see?
Well, one we've already touched on, which is this issue of confusing information with knowledge. I would say the second would be that people treat the highly unlikely as if it's impossible, i.e. oil prices could go to $130, so I don't need to worry about hedging and including some commodities in my portfolio. I don't need to worry about the recessionary impacts of such a large increase. Or bear markets where, like the Japanese have experienced since 1990, the Nikkei was 40,000, it's still only about 14,000. So it's still down something like 60 or 70% from its peak, and it's almost 20 years later. Or bear markets like 2000 and 2002, when the market dropped over 50% and the NASDAQ dropped something like 75%. They can't happen. Obviously, they can happen. They can even be worse. But people treat the unlikely as if it's impossible, and they also make the mistake of treating the likely as if it's certain. Stocks will beat bonds. Well, Japanese investors will tell you otherwise. I would say the next one would be confusing what I call the familiar with the safe. You know, it's an amazing phenomenon that people in the state of Georgia own a disproportionate share. I'm willing to bet you could guess which stock.
Yeah, Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola. Now, is it any safer, Ken, to own Coca-Cola if you live in Seattle or if you live in Atlanta?
It's going to be the same either
right,
place.
And yet people in Atlanta load up because they're familiar with it, and people in St. Louis load up probably on Anheuser-Busch, and in Seattle maybe it's Boeing. So, you know, and they make the same mistake, and they tend to under-invest internationally because they think international investments are risky while the U.S. is safe. Well, that's true of people all over the world. People in the U.K. have 90% of their money in the U.K. People in Japan have 90% of their money in Japan and in France and in Germany, all over the world. And obviously not every country can be safer than the others.
Right.
So I think that people miss out on the diversification benefits, and they should probably have 40 to 50% of their money internationally to do that. And I would say one last thing, and this is a human error in all areas, not just investing. But people are simply overconfident of their skills. Yes, it's tough to beat the market, but I can do it. You know, 90% of people say they're better than average drivers. We know that can't be true, and most people think they're better than average investors, and they delude themselves into believing they're likely to beat the market. So I tell people this, sure, it's possible to beat the market. And if you look in the mirror and you see Warren Buffett, go ahead and try. Otherwise, be a passive investor. You're almost certainly going to have a better outcome.
Well, it's not only the investors we're talking about that delude themselves. I think it's the some of the active managers that delude themselves into thinking they can beat the market.
Well, I would take exception to that. I know what you're saying. I think many of them know they are unlikely to beat the market. It's just that they can't say it because that would be committing economic suicide. In other words, there are only three types of managers or active managers. The people who know they can't beat the market. There are those, as you point out, there are those who don't know they can't beat the market. And then there is the biggest group, I think, which is those that know they can't beat the market but don't tell you that. They just keep that to themselves.
Oh, fascinating. Larry, this is Jack, and Ken and I both very much enjoyed Wise Investing Made Simple. And in that book, you mentioned in several chapters that investors should take risk in amounts that are commensurate with their willingness, ability, and need to take risk. Can you share with us, our listeners, what you mean by this?
Yeah, unfortunately, I find that even many professional advisors, and I know that the Vanguard, if you go online and you buy their advice, you know, for some relatively low fee, they don't ask the right questions, and so investors end up taking more risks than they should. And I think there are three important legs of a stool here in this equation, and if each leg isn't firmly on the ground, the stool will topple, or the plan will fail when the risk eventually shows up, which inevitably it does. The first thing that almost everybody focuses on is this ability to take risk. And there they tend to focus on, unfortunately, only one of two key issues, and that is your investment horizon. Obviously, the longer your horizon, the more risk you can take because you can wait out a bear market. The problem is that there's a second very important factor and that most people don't take into account, and that's what I call your labor capital or your human capital. And the more it correlates with the risks of stocks, the less stock risk you have the ability to take. So a good example would be a tenured professor, maybe at Washington University, or a doctor, or a dentist, or somebody like that, who's a government worker, whose income is very stable, and it doesn't matter whether the stock market's going way up or down, their income is not likely to be impacted, they're not likely to get laid off, they have more ability to take risks. In a bear market, they won't be forced to sell stocks to put food on the table. But what if you're a construction worker or an automobile worker? Your earned income is more correlated with the risks of stocks. Maybe you're a salesman, whatever, earning commissions, you know, on a business that's volatile. That is very important for individuals to consider as part of this ability to take risk. The second leg of the stool is this willingness, or what I call the stomach acid test. You have to be able to stay the course. So I tell people, build into the plan. They almost certainly were going to experience bear markets of at least 50%. And therefore, you shouldn't take more risk than you can handle. When that shows up, you cannot panic and sell. So it's easy, obviously, if you can't take a 50% loss, don't be 100% stocks. If you can't take a 25% loss, you probably shouldn't be 50% in stocks. So it's numbers like that, and my books provide these tables. But it's even worse than that, because life's too short not to enjoy it. So even if you could take a 50% drop and not panic and sell, if you're not enjoying your life and you're losing sleep, it's not worth it. So you need to be sure that you can stay the course and enjoy your life, and that's a tough thing for people to admit. Again, they tend to make two mistakes here. They're overconfident of their ability to deal with risk, and they actually dismiss the risk of 50% drops in the market. Ah, that's not going to happen. So they don't really account for it. And the third thing is this need to take risk. And that is determined by the rate of return you need to reach your goals. So a good example might be someone who's very wealthy, has, for argument's sake, $10 million, and they spend $100,000 a year. Almost won't matter what portfolio they take, they're going to survive. But they have no need to take risk because they can own a portfolio that's 100% municipal bonds, generate today about $400,000 a year in income. Why take the risk of stocks? So they should have a low equity allocation. On the other hand, you get somebody who's 25 years old and needs or wants and desires to retire and put his kids through college education and those things. Well, he may need to take a lot of risk because he needs to get maybe a 9 or 10% rate of return, so you got to be all stocks to do that.
Right.
And sometimes you get a conflict. You have a high need, but you're not a stable job, or you have a low stomach acid. And that's where a good advisor can really help by playing devil's advocate and make sure that people ask themselves the right questions and also look in the mirror seriously and give the right answers and don't lie to themselves, because I see that all the time.
Yeah.
Well, Larry, I know in your book I noticed that it was in several chapters, and for us, I mean, I caught right onto that, because all too often we find clients that come to us and they've had a bad investment experience, and there was virtually no work done on these three critical areas that you just described. And you know, they skipped right to the picking of the investment part.
Exactly. You know, Yogi Berra has a line, he was driving very fast, and said, Yogi, why are you going so quickly? So I'm making good time, but we're lost. You know, if you don't have a plan, how do you know where you're going, and how do you know how you're going to get there?
Exactly. Well, Larry, you know, Jack and I are partners in an independent registered investment advisory practice here in the Northwest. And as you know, we've embraced the passive approach. We use entirely passively managed mutual funds. We don't go out and use individual securities. And many of them, about 70% of our portfolio, are dimensional or DFA funds. And I noticed at the back of Wise Investing Made Simple, you put a table of funds and you give alternatives, and you have DFA in there, and then you have some Vanguard funds and so on. I just thought it'd be a good time to share, you know, why would an investor be better off in DFA funds? And you know, everyone needs to know that you need to have an advisor to access DFA, and without sounding self-serving, I'd love to hear what your view of why would you hire an advisor and get access to DFA?
Well, we've actually touched on some of those things, but let me point out why I put a list of both Vanguard and DFA funds and ETFs in the book. And that's because not everybody has either enough assets to hire an advisor, so they need to do it themselves, or maybe that all of their assets are tied up in their company's 401k plan, so they need to have choices, and it may not have DFA funds. But for those people who have decided they need financial advice and or could benefit from it, to me there's no question they should be using dimensional funds, because they're better designed products, they're better engineered, and they've delivered, for a variety of reasons, superior risk-adjusted returns to the Vanguard funds, and they can be generally more tax efficient, particularly with these new what are called core funds that DFA has created as well, and we can touch on that if you like. But I think the big issue is this. As I mentioned, you know, investing is really simple. All you need to do is build a globally diversified portfolio that meets your own ability, willingness, and need to take risk, and then use index funds or other passive asset class funds to, you know, implement the strategy. Then all you have to do is stay the course, rebalance, tax manage. You need to make sure your asset location is right. For example, most people get it wrong. They put their stocks in their IRAs and then hold municipal bonds. That's backwards and is costly. So, I mean, these are simple rules. They're all explained in my book, and yet most people can't do it.
Right.
They don't have the knowledge. They don't take the time. And even those that do will suffer greatly, I think, because they're human beings and they're simply subject to emotions. I think probably if you ask yourself this question, I know in my case, and I've asked it of hundreds of advisors, they'll all admit that they are much better advisors than they are investors themselves. Because even though they know the right strategies, with their own money, they are subject to the same types of mistakes that can be caused by bull and bear markets, greed and envy in bull markets, and fear and panic in bear markets, and they might lose discipline. We know with your clients' money, you're going to be totally unemotional, and you're going to give them the best advice. And therefore, it's my experience in working with hundreds of people who I've met who are pure passive. They simply don't rebalance. They don't tax manage in the most efficient way and do it uses the right funds. There are many other things that are also important, including, I think, for example, integrating an investment plan into a well-thought-out estate tax and risk management plan. So having a well-thought-out investment plan isn't enough if you don't get to execute the strategy. For example, you might die early without having the proper life insurance for your family to survive on, or you didn't have disability insurance, or
right.
You're older and you didn't plan for long-term health care, and so your portfolio gets depleted. So all of these issues are important in having a good advisor. You know, and one of the things I'll conclude with, I think, is this. One of my favorite expressions is this. Millions of people know the price of everything and the value of nothing.
Right.
In other words, we don't all go to the cheapest restaurant, we don't buy the cheapest clothes, and we don't go to the cheapest doctors unless you have a pure commodity, okay? Investment advice is not a pure commodity. There are skilled surgeons, there are skilled advisors, and you should find one who can provide you with the most value.
Well, Larry, along that line, in that vein, you know, if you're deciding between two advisors that are both employing a passive approach, what's your advice to the individual out there in terms of how do you pick that advisor?
If all you're looking for is access to DFA funds, you can choose the one with the cheapest fees, but I think that would be a big mistake. As an just one small example, my firm manages taxes throughout the year. So in other words, if a fund goes down in January, we're going to be selling it, harvesting those losses, and it may go down again in February, and we'll repeat the process. But if that fund were to then rally, and by the end of the year there'd be no loss, the advisor who is only managing that at the end of the year, as most individuals and I believe most advisors do, you would have lost the opportunity to loss harvest. So there's one simple example. But I give in my book, in the last chapter, 11 things, a checklist of things that an investor should look for. They should be, of course, a fiduciary standard of care. They should back up all of their advice with academic research. They should check to see if the advisor is investing their money in exactly the same things that they're recommending. I'm happy to show my portfolio to any prospect. My firm invests our retirement plan in one of the portfolios that we recommend to clients. You want to make sure that all conflicts of interest are disclosed, and you want to make sure that the advice is given by people who have, you know, the right academic backgrounds and maybe the right initials, be they CFPs or PFSs or whatever they might be.
Larry, you touched on setting the proper groundwork for the investor and making sure that, you know, they're getting into an allocation that really fits their needs and their temperament. And what Ken and I have found as a great benefit of a good advisor is, you know, for times like this when the market's uncertain and scary, you know, it's for someone to really hold their feet to the fire and you know, for their particular goals and not jump in and out and not panic.
I mean, there's all kinds of ways a good advisor adds value, and I would encourage people in a meeting that they go through what I would call a discovery process, and that should be a two-way street. So you're asking lots of questions of the advisor about how they work with people, how often they communicate with them, ask for references, and, you know, find out about, you know how often they actually do communicate. When we have bear markets like this, are they calling their clients to ask how they're feeling, making sure they're not going to panic and addressing questions they might have? All of those things are important. But you should also look to see what the advisor is asking. In that process, are they asking you about your individual and unique attributes that determine your ability, willingness, and need to take risks? What your goals are? Do you want to leave money to charity? What about your children? You know, what's important about money to you? You know, do you want to make sure you put your kids through a good education, or, you know, all these other issues in terms of risk management? Have you thought about long-term health care? What's your life insurance? Do you have wills and trusts, and make sure that things are, you know, documented in the right names? I mean, I've even come across cases where a poor guy had gotten divorced. His second wife had now been 20 years, and the guy never changed his IRA designation. He died, and the first wife got all the money.
Oh, that's...
I mean, horrible stories like that. Or someone dies without life insurance because they didn't think it was going to happen. They're a healthy 31-year-old. These are all issues that I think should be explored. And if the advisor isn't asking these questions and they're just trying to sell you investment advice, I'd go find somebody who's looking at it in a much broader way.
Great point.
Yeah. Larry, I've read books by authors who advocate market efficiency and thus espouse the benefits of passive investing with a heavy emphasis on cost reduction, while giving little credence to the value of an advisor relationship. For example, John Bogle and Burton McHale are two authors I respect greatly, and I felt they missed the mark years ago by downplaying the value of a qualified advisor. Recently, I've read interviews published in Advisor Perspectives, and where they interviewed both John and Burton, and they both seem to be more pro-advisor than previously. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we touched on these issues, and I think the evidence is very clear, just from these academic studies, that people are overconfident in their skills. They really need an advisor to hold their hand, because even in the case of Vanguard and the people who use index funds, the average investor, as we said, has time-weighted returns that are higher than their actual dollar-weighted returns they earn because they don't stay the course. That's number one. And you get into all these other complex issues we talk. In other words, the bottom line to me is this. People should only pay for value added. And if an advisor in your meeting with them can't convince you that they're going to add value, you shouldn't pay for it. And how they add value can be done in many ways. I will say this. That we work with in our firm over 1,500 relationships directly at Buckingham Asset Management. And our clients have been thrilled with the results of passive strategies using DFA. But I will tell you, a consistent theme that we hear from our clients is this. While we've been happy with the results from a monetary perspective, far more important to us is you've improved the quality of our lives, because we stop watching CNBC, we tune out the news, and we're able to devote that time that we used to waste on investments to our family, our hobbies, you know, or whatever is important to us, community service, your synagogue or church or whatever. And so we've really improved their quality of life, which to me is a priceless benefit.
I love the Big Rocks example you use in your book.
That's exactly right. That's where I got that story from, is from talking with a client about it.
That's great.
How do you explain to investors the differences between paying the high fees for active management, which are in many cases hidden, and paying a fee to an advisor such as your firm or our firm, Empirical, who utilizes a passive approach, whose fees are, you know, right out on the table?
Well, number one is you should only pay for value added, and the evidence shows that with active management, you pay high fees and get lousy results. So I wouldn't mind paying a high fee if you got great results. But the problem with active management is you pay high fees and get lousy results. So bad advice doesn't come cheaply. It's very expensive. That's rule number one. With a good advisor, I think the evidence is very clear that they can add a lot of value, both in terms of the investment strategy, but also integrating the investment plan into an estate tax and risk management plan. And there is the benefit of the value added. And I think you need nothing more than look at the results of these mutual fund studies to demonstrate it solely on the basis of just keeping people disciplined, making sure they tax manage throughout the year, do so in the most cost-efficient way. And then you get the benefits of the DFA funds, which have provided superior returns. Generally, that should be sufficient to cover the cost of the advisor. And then you get the value of the advice basically as that free lunch, if you will.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's great, Larry. Larry, I have a multi-part question for you here. Number one, what should an investor do when the media is reporting that we are in a recession, that the U.S. economy has entered a recession? And two, along that line, how do you respond to the question we often get after the market's declined and the media is reporting negative news about the economy? How do you respond to the question, is now a good time to be in the market?
Yeah, well, I think the most important thing I try to teach investors is where we actually began the story in our interview here, which is that all they're doing when they make those statements, they're confusing with information with knowledge or wisdom that you can use. In other words, if they're reading we're in a recession, they hear it from Cramer, they have all this stuff, that means the prices are already in the market and it's too late to do anything about it. It's completely irrelevant. The key is if you could have predicted it way ahead of time and gotten out way before the recession began, then you might have had some value. But here's some evidence I want to show you that I think will shock most people. Ken, let's assume that you were the only person in the whole world who actually had this skill, because this person doesn't exist, and you could forecast when a recession would begin, and you could forecast the day it would end. Obviously, we know no one has ever done that, and certainly for any individual recession probably, but there are 11 recessions in the post-war era. Okay, so mm-hmm. you would get out of the market using that kind of knowledge, the way most of your listeners would believe, on the day before the recession begins, and you would get back in the day after it ends. If you could do that with 100% certainty, you would have actually been worse off than if you did nothing, because the stock market on average went up 7.1% during those 11 recessions, and one-month treasury bills, the place maybe you park your money during that period, only earned 5.1%. So you were 2% worse off, even with 100% foresight, and that's not counting the tax and other costs, trading costs, of implementing such a strategy. And that's because the markets are forward-looking. They already incorporate what's happening today, and they're looking out 6 months or a year to what might happen, and unfortunately, none of us have clear crystal balls.
Certainly a contrast to conventional Wall Street wisdom, which would lead us to believe that it's actually possible to avoid market downturns.
I've got one other story I think is a terrific one that your readers would benefit from. Let's say you could forecast with certainty all the economic events, and I'm going to give you a bunch of things that occurred. It was at the start of 2003, and that year, what happened? The Iraq War began, and it's 5 years later, and we're still there. We had a SARS virus that was threatening to shut down world trade. We had North Korea threatening nuclear holocaust, shooting off bombs and all kinds of other stuff. You know, we had a threat of global deflation. Nobody maybe even remembers that. China and India were spreading this global deflation around the globe and all this other stuff. And then we had mutual fund scandals all over the place that were destroying investor confidence. And then we had Enron and MCI, all these blow-ups. Now, if you knew with 100% certainty that those things were going to happen, I know I would sell the market, right?
Right.
Why would you want to be in when all those horrible things were happening? And yet, the model portfolio that we show our clients, that is a diversified global equity portfolio using DFA funds, was up 50% that year.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody, even with accurate economic forecasts, and no such person exists, is useless. And if you can't get the economic forecast right, then how can you get the stock market right?
That's right.
Based on an economic forecast.
Larry, one more question for me, and it relates to commodities. At our firm, we've had a small allocation of commodities since 2006, and through our research efforts, we concluded years ago that commodities had a small place in a portfolio. However, we waited until efficient, passively managed vehicles came to the marketplace before we invested there. And I found that academics and advisors are divided on the issue of commodities, and it was interesting to notice in your book that you're in agreement with our conclusion that commodities do have a place in a portfolio. Could you explain to us why you believe in allocating a small amount to commodities? And could you also explain your view on whether you would ever reduce or increase the exposure to commodities based on the valuations they reach?
Well, it's a lot of good questions rolled up in there. I think, first of all, I'd say this, the academic community, this is one issue where people are divided on. I don't think there's a clear-cut answer to the question. I believe the preponderance of evidence favors owning commodities in the portfolio, adding a small piece. And I think the downside risk of including it is very minimal, while not including it can be more damaging. So I, too, when I found the academic research, there wasn't a good fund around, so I didn't invest. And then PIMCO came out with its fund, which I think is the best available for a couple of reasons. And one of the main ones is it's passive. Another is they use TIPS as the underlying collateral. So you get what's called a double real return strategy. And that should provide significantly higher returns than, say, a three-month treasury bill would be, which is the typical underlying collateral. So that's a big advantage there. But to me, the issue of commodities is this. Why do you want to add them? It comes down to this. Commodities should be viewed as portfolio insurance. Now, we insure lots of things in our life. We insure our health, medical insurance. We have long-term health care. We have life insurance, disability, automobile insurance, umbrella policies, all in the case of unlikely events or unexpected events happening. Well, commodities are really the same thing. They tend to have very low returns most of the time and for very long periods. It could go a decade or more. When things are going along smoothly, commodities are going to have low returns. Okay?
Right.
But they tend to do very well when there are crises, because it may be an oil crisis like we're having now, or when you have high inflation and the stocks and bonds are getting hit. If Israel attacked, sent a nuclear bomb, or plane to take out the Iranian nuclear facility, then that might cause oil prices to go to $200 a barrel. Certainly that would have a damaging effect to stocks. And so commodities have what's called negative correlation to equities and bonds. And most people don't understand what that means. Negative correlation does not mean when one goes up, the other goes down. What it means is this. When one produces a high average return, then, or above average return, the other tends to produce a below average return. So let me give you the data. In the research I did found the following. In the 9 years that bonds had negative returns since 1970, commodities were up in every one of the years, and they were up an average of almost 30%. In the 8 years that's before this one, that stocks had negative returns, okay, commodities were up 6 of the 8, and they produced an average plus, including the 2 down years, of plus 23%. So just when you need them to have great returns because the other parts of your portfolio are doing poorly, they tend to produce spectacular returns. So even a small amount of the portfolio can help. And what people fail to understand about commodities is they make a common error, one made by many advisors, even professionals. They tend to look at the asset in isolation. And Harry Markowitz, of course, won a Nobel Prize to show that's wrong. What you need to look at how the addition of an asset class impacts the risk of the overall portfolio. So I'd like to give you one little bit of data that I think will shock people. I did a little reverse data mining and chose the worst period I could start maybe commodities with. And I started in 1991, a decade after that was terrible, and I ran it through 07, and commodities would have returned only about 6.8%, and their volatility was like 26%. Mm-hmm. Now, during the same period, the S&P was up 11.5 roughly, and a volatility of only 17. Why would you ever want to add this asset with a much lower return and much higher volatility? Well, it turns out if you added 10% commodities to 100% S&P portfolio, you would have ended up with a slightly higher return, and volatility would have dropped significantly. Instead of 17%, it would have been 15%. So commodities tend to make the portfolio less volatile without damaging the return, long-term returns. That's particularly important for retirees who are withdrawing money from the portfolio, because volatility can kill the portfolio, causing it to run out of money. Because when you withdraw, you can't recover anymore when markets eventually recover. So you need to dampen volatility. So it's kind of strange. The very people who should own commodities the most probably own it the least, meaning these retirees, because they think of it in isolation as a very risky asset.
Right.
You know, tag on that, Larry. How does gold relate to the commodities?
Well, gold is just one commodity, and I don't want to own just one commodity. I want to own a diversified mix of commodities. I think that's, you actually get a diversification benefit there. The return of the overall commodity index will be higher than the average of the individual components. But let me come back to your other question. I'm sorry I didn't answer it before.
That's okay.
What do you do with commodities now with prices so high? Well, my analogy is to insurance again. Let's say you lived in New Orleans and you didn't have insurance, okay, for a hurricane. And the hurricane comes, and now you got to buy insurance, but you find that insurance rates are jacked up. Do you not buy insurance now?
Yeah. Okay. That's
a
good point there.
You know, we don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
Your portfolio still needs insurance, and oil just as easily could be 200 as it drops to 50. I think the right strategy is simply to bite the bullet, invest a small portion of your portfolio in insurance, and pray you never collect. We want commodities to do poorly, because if they do, that means generally our stocks and bonds, which are probably 95% of the portfolio, are going to be doing great, and we don't collect on our premium. But that's not bad, because we're not unhappy when we don't collect on our life insurance or fire insurance either, right?
That's right.
Larry,
I think you just have to bite the bullet. And one strategy you might employ is, okay, so I'm going to dollar cost average in because the price is so high, but I still believe you should just bite the bullet. You know, I got this question when oil was at 50 and at 60 and at 80 and 100, and, you know, and maybe it'll keep getting when it's 200. I don't know what the price of oil will be. I'm rooting for it to collapse, even though I own a significant position in the PIMCO commodity fund.
Right.
But I'd rather the rest of my portfolio do well.
Larry, this may be more of a statement than a question, but I would be interested in your comments. You know, us, Empirical Wealth Management, like you, we're just absolutely convinced on the superiority of the passive approach. And, you know, sometimes we find it a little confusing or frustrating that, you know, more people don't understand that and are not more quick to embrace it.
Well, the reason I think is easy to understand, and that's because we're right where we started from. The education system has failed the public, so they've been hearing one thing about how markets work, maybe in some cases 60, 70 years. It's hard for people then to be told that what they've heard all these years is wrong, because often they hear it as, they're telling me I'm stupid. And that's obviously not what you mean.
Right.
What you mean is they were ignorant of the data. Now, I think I'm reasonably intelligent. I graduated at number one in one of the top MBA programs in the country. But I'm ignorant about lots of things. Nuclear physics, my wife and three daughters tell me women. It doesn't mean I'm stupid, you know. And it's unfortunate that people are unaware of the data and the evidence. And therefore, they get defensive often, unfortunately, and that prevents them from taking the right action. That's why I've written these books. Hopefully, when they read it, they get this aha moment and say, boy, it all makes sense. Everyone, I think, who reads my books comes away and says, boy, Larry, this really makes sense. I now understand it. And I found that most of the people who read the books walk away and have a changed approach. Not everybody. Some people are just stubborn. You'll never convince them.
Well, we're doing our job over here in the Northwest to do the same thing, get the word out. Larry, I know we're about out of time, but I've got just one, at least one more question for you.
All right.
You know, who do you look up to in our industry?
Well, a few people who I have the highest regard for. Probably the number one would be John Bogle. While I don't agree with him on some key issues, he said you didn't need international investing, and I think he's even changing his mind on that.
Right.
He said value stocks haven't had higher returns. I think he was wrong there because he made a mistake comparing the returns of value mutual funds to value growth funds, and they were actively managed funds. Clearly, the data shows that value stocks have outperformed. But John is a tireless proponent for the individual investor to get them educated. He cares deeply to do the right thing, and he's written several books I'd highly recommend to people, and he is a great human being. He's still out there pushing hard. He doesn't need the money, but he's trying hard to do the right thing for the average person. So I have tremendous respect for John. I would say William Bernstein is an author who I recommend wholeheartedly to people who want to learn. After my books, go read Bill's. And in the press, unfortunately, there's only a handful of people who really, I think, care about doing the right thing. And one of them we lost, Jonathan Clements. He left the Wall Street Journal to go to the dark side at Citicorp, I'm afraid.
I'm surprised.
But Jason Zweig is replacing him, and I think Jason's one of the great lights here. Jane Bryan Quinn is another good one, Humberto Cruz and Scott Burns, and then you start running out of names. And lastly, I really want to thank the people at Dimensional Fund Advisors who have provided me access to some of the top academic minds in the field, Professors Ken French and Gene Farmer and some of the other people at DFA, including Weston Wellington, who I've learned so much from, and the generosity they have in sharing their knowledge and taking the time to educate me on these issues. And so I'd be reticent if I did not mention it.
Well, Larry, we really want to thank you for taking the time to do this interview with us and come on our show. And I think we strongly recommend that every listener out there buy your, especially your most recent book, Wise Investing Made Simple. And all of your books actually are excellent. And I think I've pretty much read every one of them. So thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Now we got to get you to pick up the new book in November. And by the way, I'm happy to come back anytime.
What's the name of the new book, Larry?
The new book is the completion of my long-anticipated trilogy that I've been working on now for 13 years. The first book was The Only Guide to Winning Investment Strategy You'll Ever Need, which focused almost exclusively on equities. And then a couple of years ago, I came out with The Only Guide to Winning Bond Strategy to focus on the fixed income. And now the completion, this is The Only Guide to Alternative Investments You'll Ever Need. So hedge funds and venture capital, real estate, we go into depth on commodities as well, preferred stocks and covered call writing, equity indexed annuities and all kinds of structured notes on Wall Street. So I think investors will benefit greatly. I call it the good, the flawed, the bad, and the ugly.
That's a good one.
Well, we'll definitely look forward to that one.
Great.
The advice given on this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended as investment advice. Please consult a financial advisor before undertaking any investment decisions. While the show's producers have tried to provide accurate and timely information and have relied on sources they believe to be reliable, the show may include inadvertent technical or factual inaccuracies. Jack Monteith and Ken Smith do not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the materials provided and expressly disclaim any warranties or merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose.